Greetings, everyone. This is Robin Jones, and I am your moderator for today's session. I want to welcome everyone to this first of our series, and for this particular fiscal year for us, and for those of you who are not familiar with our process, we operate on a federal fiscal year of October 1st through September 30th. We've had a little bit of delay getting started in this series due to the fact that we had a transition from 1 5-year grant cycle to another, and so it's taken us a little bit of a while to gear back up with the legal webinar series, but we're happy to be back into the series, and we're glad that all of you have joined us today. Just going to go through a couple of the logistical issues to get started before we go. And one is just to remind people, we do have closed captioning available. The captioning is available by hitting the CC icon at the top of your screen, and then you can adjust the captioning screen as needed. Many people often don't know that you can actually customize your view of the entire webinar platform itself by choosing View from the drop-down menu at the top of your screen, and you can choose the layout that you prefer. If you want to try different ones, you can get a larger view of the whiteboard and such, so that's something that you may want to explore. Those of you that are going to be asking questions, and we hope you are today, you can submit your questions in the chat area text box. The keystroke for doing that is Control-M. You will not be able to see the questions that are submitted. We have the chat area closed to you, but our presenters and speakers are able to see the chat area, and you will be cued as to when you can and when we want you to submit your questions for response by our speakers today. We do ask you to refrain from using any of the emotions and hand-raising aspects of the webinar platform. They do tend to distract and confuse sometimes people who are watching the webinar. So we just ask that you refrain from that, please. We are going to be doing a couple of queries from you, engaging you and asking you some questions and to ask you to respond. So we're going to be using some of the polling features today. When you're prompted, you will want to click on either the A, B, or C, which will appear under the section for the participants. And that particular issue also has control keystrokes of A is control 1, B is control 2, and C is control 3 for those of you using keyboard. We also have some yes-no options available. Again, you'll click the X or the check mark for yes or no, and keyboard shortcuts again for that are yes is control 1 and no is control 2. So at this time, I'm going to turn over the session to our presenters. For those of you who are familiar with the program, have been with us for a long time, you'll see familiar names joining us again this year. And that is Barry Taylor, who is the Legal Advocacy Director for Equip for Equality, which is the Protection and Advocacy Agency for the state of Illinois, and Alan Goldstein, who is the Senior Attorney for Equip for Equality. Both of our presenters' full biographical information is available on our website at the www.ada-audio.org under the Legal Webinar Series link. And so I won't spend any additional time, and just would refer you to that particular area to get more information about our presenters in detail. So Barry and Alan, I am going to go ahead and hand over the microphone to you at this time.
Thanks, Robin. Hi, everybody. This is Barry Taylor. I'll be starting out, and Alan will be speaking. And welcome to another webinar series. We're glad to have you here to talk about the ADA in the healthcare setting. For those of you who are attorneys in Illinois, this session is eligible for 1.5 hours of continuing legal education credit. All you have to do is send me an email after the session is over, and that's barryt@equipforequality.org, and then I will give you the information to give you your continuing legal education credit, and we'll have the slide up at the end as well. We always like to do a quick question just to see who's joining us today, and this is one of those polling features that Robin had mentioned before. We'd like to know if you identify yourself as an advocate for people with disabilities. If so, you can select A or control 1. If you represent employers or other covered entities like healthcare providers, you can select B or control 2. And if you're just what we call an innocent, unbiased bystander, you can select C or control 3. So if you could do that now, we'll look at the results to see who's joining us today. Remember that A, B, and C is in the participant box in the upper left corner. Okay, Alan, can you give us the results? So if you'll see that we have a pretty good split here. 21% of you are advocates for people with disabilities. 29% represent employers or healthcare providers or other covered entities. We have a few innocent, unbiased bystanders, 9%, and then there's about 40% of you who decided not to participate in the poll this time around. So thanks for those of you who selected, and let's get on with the webinar. So let me tell you how we're going to be doing this today. We're dividing it up into two sections. I'm going to start first and talk about healthcare from the context of employees with disabilities in the healthcare setting. And there are two primary focuses that we're going to have today, and this is where most of the case law is. One is reasonable accommodations that healthcare workers with disabilities seek and how courts have interpreted those. And then, and that will look at issues including being qualified to perform essential job functions. And then the other thing we're going to focus on is direct threats to health and safety, which is the other major legal issue that comes up for healthcare workers in their employment setting. We're not going to really focus on confidentiality today, which is another issue that comes up, because we do have a webinar later in the year that is devoted solely to confidentiality issues, not only the ADA, but other laws as well. So we won't be focusing on that today, but later in the year we will. We'll then stop for a few minutes to see if people have any questions and answer those. And then Alan will start up and talk about issues regarding people who are more accessing the healthcare situation, healthcare environment, who have disabilities. So that this would normally be under Title III, public accommodations, and some public entities, Title II, that are healthcare providers as well. And Alan will be talking a number of topics. He'll be talking about some of the pending Department of Justice regulations that focus on accessible medical equipment. He'll also focus on one of the major legal issues that comes up for patients with disabilities, which is, do they have the legal standing to bring an ADA suit? And he'll explain what that means. We'll also talk about issues involving patients living with HIV, because there have been an enormous number of cases involving patients with HIV and how that's affected their healthcare experience and the ADA. We'll also look at effective communication, which is the other major area of litigation that we've seen in this context. Alan will also talk about service animals in a healthcare setting, and then focus on some settlements by the Department of Justice and some other entities as well. So let's turn and we'll talk about the first topic under employment, which is reasonable accommodation. And generally, the analysis we're going to be talking about would apply to any reasonable accommodations setting that employers and employees would be facing. But what we found is that in the healthcare setting, the courts tend to be more deferential and because of potential safety concerns, and they just seem to be more deferential to the decisions of healthcare worker, healthcare providers when we have healthcare workers who are seeking accommodations. And so I think you're going to see more of a conservative type of view of cases maybe than you've seen in other reasonable accommodation contexts. So I just want to give you that heads up. The other thing to note is that I think with if the healthcare reform that has been passed by Congress is ultimately implemented and the Supreme Court doesn't disallow that, I think we're going to see more health care cases, and because we're going to have more people accessing the health care. And also, now that we have the ADA Amendments Act passed, there were a lot of health care worker cases that were brought where people didn't get to whether they were appropriately accommodated or were a direct threat because they were deemed not to have a disability. And now that the ADA Amendments Act has said it's easier to show you have a disability, I think we're going to see more litigation in the future. The other general thing I wanted to mention, we have a couple slides that just go over reasonable accommodation in general, which we're not going to spend time on, but just to remind people that the reasonable accommodation process is an interactive process. Employers should respond expeditiously, and that employers' requirement is to provide an effective accommodation, not necessarily the preferred accommodation. And we have some links for you to EEOC guidance as well as some briefs that we've done on reasonable accommodation. What we see in the healthcare worker context is generally two sort of categories. One is nurses with disabilities seeking accommodations, and the other are surgical techs and doctors. And generally, the courts have been more accommodating of nurses than they have of surgical techs and doctors. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later, but let's first talk about some of the cases. The first case we have here is one in which the a nurse had a back problem. This is the Griffin case. And as a result of her back problem, she had a 25-pound lifting limit. But when you looked at the job description, it said that she had to lift 40 pounds. And she requested an accommodation to not have to lift 40 pounds, but to be able to only have to do lifting less than 25 pounds. And the court ultimately found that she was not entitled to that accommodation, that lifting was an essential function. They focused on the fact that the lifting 40 pounds was in the job description, but they said it's not just that it's in the job description. They also looked at how nurses actually worked in this particular workplace and found pretty clear evidence that they were required on a regular basis to lift 40 pounds or more. And what the nurse had said is, in context where she can't lift more than 25 pounds, she was asking for other people to assist her, other nurses to assist her. And this court interpreted that request as really requiring the healthcare provider to create a new position, which they said was not required under the ADA. One of the important things I think the court focused on was that another essential function for her was to respond to emergencies, and oftentimes there would be a requirement in emergencies for one nurse to have to do lifting of more than 25 pounds, and that really essentially rendered her not qualified as a nurse with that restriction. We've got a couple of other cases with similar facts, the Ingerson case and the Amigo case at the bottom of this slide. I failed to mention that after this session is over, you will have an email that will give you a legal brief that is much more detailed, has more cases and more detailed analysis of the cases we're talking about. So today is the PowerPoint to give you an overview, but if you do want more details, you will have that sent to you by email. A case similar to the Griffin case is another case involving a nurse who had limitations and was seeking an accommodation. This nurse in the Staffney case had rheumatoid arthritis, and she had walking limitations. Her doctor had said that she would need a totally sedentary sit-down job and could only do seated work. And so what she had requested as an accommodation was to use a motorized scooter called an Amigo in the workplace, and that was what she needed to do her job. And the employer said, we're not going to provide that accommodation. We're not going to allow you to use that in the workplace. And the court affirmed a jury verdict that found for the employer here. I think the problem the nurse had here was she was not able to demonstrate how she could do some of her essential functions while in the Amigo. One was pushing other people in wheelchairs, which is something nurses did in that context, and also performing certain emergency procedures, like the Heimlich maneuver, they found would be difficult. She was not showing that she could do that from a seated position. And so as a result, they found, again, that she was not qualified and the accommodations did not have to be provided. The last case is another case in which you had a healthcare worker seeking an accommodation. This case involved a kidney dialysis technician who had clinical depression, and he was terminated because of irregular attendance that was resulting from adverse side effects that he had from medication. And technician was seeking was to be able to have changes in a work schedule, but it wasn't that she was just seeking time off once a week to go to a therapy appointment or that kind of thing. Instead, she was saying these were sudden and unscheduled absences because, again, of the side effects of her medication. And so the employer said, I'm sorry, we just can't accommodate that. That's too unpredictable for us, and you're really leaving us in a bad place. It's an undue hardship to provide that accommodation. And the court agreed that type of sort of irregular request of changing of schedule was not something the employer had to accommodate. But as I mentioned before, courts have found some accommodations appropriate for nurses, and interestingly, some of these cases have similar facts to the ones we've already talked about, but the courts have gone the other way. A good example of that is the Sydnor case, S-Y-D-N-O-R, a case out of Virginia, and this is very similar to a case that we had talked about before involving a nurse seeking to use a wheelchair. This was a nurse who had a variety of conditions, including fibromyalgia, arthritis, and back conditions. And she had gone on leave under the Family Medical Leave Act, but even after her leave had expired after 12 weeks, she still had some significant lifting and walking limitations, and she had asked if she could use a wheelchair. as when she returned and to do her job. The thing that happened here is that the defendant didn't contradict the doctor's note that said that the plaintiff could perform her essential functions from a lightweight wheelchair. And so there was no counter evidence from the employer, which may have made a difference in this case. And the thing that the plaintiff did here was explain how she could do some of the different essential functions from a seated position. And I think the other thing that was hurtful to the healthcare provider here was there were some bad statements that were made by the employer here. The supervisor was quoted as saying, you know, she should just stay on disability, that when she's in a wheelchair, she takes up too much space in the workplace. And then also he said something along the lines of, if I were a patient, I wouldn't want my nurse to be in a wheelchair. So you had some pretty inflammatory statements by the employer, which certainly didn't help them with the court. Another case where we have a nurse winning a case is the Wright case, W-R-I-G-H-T, and this was a registered nurse who had significant hearing loss. And she was placed on leave and subject to different fitness for duty tests after there's some problems with communication. And she had received a pager to help her in the workplace, but she had sought some additional accommodations like text telephone, TTY, telephone amplifiers. I guess this nurse had to talk to people on the phone when they called about different prescription issues. She also wanted to have a visual alarm if there were emergencies and a sign language interpreter for larger meetings. She was okay with small meetings and direct patient contact, but when there were larger meetings, she needed a sign language interpreter. And the employer said, you know, if you look at our job description, it says that good hearing acuity is an essential function, and you don't have that, so therefore you're not qualified to do the job, and they did not agree to do any accommodations beyond giving her a pager. And the court found that even though it was in the job description itself, that did not mean that it was necessarily an essential function. And the hospital did not do a good job here specifying what functions were problematic and why the good hearing acuity without accommodations was an essential function. And so therefore, the court found in favor of the nurse here. Now we're going to shift into some cases involving doctors and surgical technicians, and as we'll see, the courts in many of these cases take a more conservative view with respect to providing accommodations. The Robertson case involves a doctor who was had ADHD, and he had some difficulties in handling paperwork, and the healthcare provider said that paperwork was really an essential function of being a doctor. He had requested that he get an administrative assistant to help him. And, you know, it's arguable, I think, that handling paperwork is an essential function of a doctor, and that really when you think about doctors, you're talking about people who are, you know, providing medical care as opposed to doing paperwork. But I guess the problem here was that he had made mistakes in patients' charts and made mistakes in dispensing medication, and that they considered that all as part of the paperwork. And therefore, he posed a direct threat, and that the accommodation that he was seeking of getting an administrative assistant to do that work really wasn't reasonable because they needed to have medical knowledge that an administrative assistant wouldn't have, and so therefore they found that it would be an undue hardship to provide that accommodation and that he was not qualified. The Branson case is a case actually where we had a doctor winning, and this was is actually under Title III, but it's an employment case because Dr. Branson was an independent contractor. So it's the same analysis, but technically because they're not she wasn't an employee, it's under Title III, but it's still the same analysis. So she had paraplegia, and she used a service dog to mostly pull her manual wheelchair so that she didn't have to overuse her upper extremities. And the healthcare provider had asked that she not have a service animal. They didn't like the fact that there would be a dog in the healthcare setting, and instead said, we'll accommodate you to use a motorized wheelchair. So the question was that an effective accommodation or not? And she said, you know, it really isn't, because I not only use my service animal to help me move my chair, I also use the service animal pick up items, and the animal actually helps me transfer out of my wheelchair by providing pressure on me. So the motorized wheelchair, while effective on some issues, was not really an effective accommodation overall. And the the healthcare provider wouldn't relent, and so the suit was brought, and the court agreed with the doctor here and said that they had violated the Federal Rehab Act. This was under the Federal Rehab Act because it was a Veterans Administration facility. And the thing that the Veterans Administration facility didn't do was show any kind of undue burden or direct threat. There was evidence that other that patients were able to bring in seeing eye dogs, and therefore this doctor having a service animal in the healthcare setting couldn't be a direct threat if those seeing eye dogs weren't a direct threat. Another thing you'll see that's common in a lot of these job descriptions, especially for nurses, but also for other healthcare professionals, is that they'd be able to do what's called training and ability to take down a patient. This is kind of if there's an emergency and you need to subdue a patient who is acting out of control. And the courts really are split down the middle on this from the decisions we've seen. We've given you two here. One is the Henniger case. And in that case, they found that that kind of takedown training was an essential function. The physician's assistant said, you know, this hasn't been required for 8 years. I don't think I should have to do this. I can't do this. And the court said, even though it's not something that happens often, it's a very important thing that could happen. And therefore, if you can't do it, you're not qualified to be a physician's assistant. But then you have the Johnston case out of Florida, which said went the other way and said that it wasn't clear that this takedown training was an essential function for a nurse. And again, they looked at the fact that this nurse who had been doing this work for many years had never had a situation where she had to provide a takedown. And so therefore, the fact that she couldn't do that and undergo the training didn't mean that she was not qualified. So that's one where, you know, it's hard to say what the general rule is because the courts are split. So since we've talked about this dichotomy between nurses and doctors, we just wanted to see what people thought. Do you think nurses should be accommodated more readily than doctors? Do you feel like courts should be more conservative with respect to doctors because of their different types of responsibilities? If you think yes, nurses should be accommodated more readily than doctors, you can press A or press Control 1. Or if you think that the nurse shouldn't be accommodated more than doctors, should be the same, you can do B or no. And I guess I'm wrong on that. It's actually a check mark. So if you think yes, hit the check mark, and if you think no, hit the X that's in the participant box. Let's see if we have any results here. Should nurses be more accommodated than doctors? And what we found here is that most of you said no. Those of you who voted overwhelmingly thought that there should not be this difference. 41% of you said no, and 6% said yes, and 50% of you didn't vote this time around, aren't sure. Great. Let's move on to the next issue. As I mentioned, the other major legal issue we see in healthcare worker cases with disabilities is the issue of direct threat. And we've done legal webinars on direct threat before, so we're not going to spend time giving you a lot of information. But as you remember, there is a defense under the ADA that says if you can show that a person is a significant risk of substantial harm to the health or safety of others in the workplace, and that harm, a risk, cannot be eliminated or reduced by reasonable accommodation, then it's considered a direct threat and they can be relieved from their duties in the workplace or not hired. And we do have a brief that you can look at if you're interested in more details, and there's a link for that. Generally, as in the accommodation context, courts have been more deferential to healthcare providers in direct threat cases than in other types of employment context due to concerns of patient safety. And for example, in the 90s through probably 2001, there were a lot of cases involving healthcare workers with HIV, and the direct threat analysis was much, much more strict in the healthcare worker case than we were seeing in other contexts. And almost uniformly, those healthcare workers lost those cases. We've got an example of the most recent case we could find, the Waddell case, W-A-D-D-E-L-L. And this was a case involving a dental hygienist who had HIV, and they terminated her when they found out about her being HIV positive. And even though she had put forth evidence that the risk of transmission was low or even seemingly hypothetical, that she could transmit her HIV to a patient, they said this is not a case where we want somebody to die first before we find a direct threat, so we're going to go with it. And so even though they the standard was that you have to show a significant risk, and the testimony was that the risk was very low or seemingly non-existent, the court still found she was a direct threat. So they disregarded basically the standard of the ADA because they thought the substantial harm was so high, and at the time there weren't a lot of drugs and people were dying more readily with HIV. The court took a very conservative view here and found that Ms. Waddell was a direct threat. And what's interesting is we look to see if there's been a lot of any cases on this topic since 2001, and we couldn't really find any reported cases focusing on this. There's certainly probably been some filed, but none that have been reported. And it's hard to know exactly why that is, but you know, the hopeful view is that people and courts and employers are becoming more educated about how HIV is transmitted and not taking the sort of knee-jerk reaction that if somebody has HIV in the workplace, they're immediately a direct threat. But again, we don't have really any cases to look at to know sort of why that analysis is different or why those cases aren't coming up as readily as they did before. And if you look at the legal brief that I mentioned before, you'll get a lot more of the cases if you're interested in sort of the more historical view of this issue. In addition to HIV, there are other issues that have come up as well. One is the issue of healthcare workers having seizures in the workplace, and the Johnson case is a good example of that. This was in Johnson, you had a nurse who had a history of fibromyalgia and seizures, and her seizures began to increase, and she had a difficult time addressing those in the workplace, and oftentimes when she had these seizures, she would, they called it spacing out for 10 to 15 seconds without warning, and the employer said, and the court agreed, that it was unsafe for her to perform her jobs, and they talked about that she had a responsibility for handling emergency situations, giving injections, drawing blood, handling medications, doing triage, and that if you had somebody who was doing those kinds of seizures without a lot of prior warning, that could be a threat to patient safety. The other thing that was difficult about this case was that she was not only a nurse, but she was a nurse in a detention facility, which raised security concerns. So there were health concerns as well as security concerns about having a nurse who spaces out due to her seizures. And so generally courts are very deferential to both healthcare providers and to correctional facilities, and here you had both, and so the court took a more conservative view than maybe in other contexts. Another case involving a healthcare worker with a direct threat is the Jakubowski case, and this is a medical resident who had Asperger's syndrome. And although he tested very high on medical knowledge, he had gotten very negative reviews from other doctors about his communication skills with patients as well as with his colleagues at work. And the healthcare provider ultimately found that as a result of his poor communication skills, he was actually placing his patients at risk. What he had asked for as an accommodation was really vague. He had asked that the healthcare provider give him knowledge and understanding to address his concerns. And, you know, that's just, the court said that's just not a concrete accommodation to provide knowledge and understanding. And accommodations are supposed to help you perform the essential functions, and giving somebody knowledge and understanding really doesn't allow somebody to improve his communication and interaction skills. So they found that request to be one that the employer did not have to provide. There was some discussion in this case about maybe reassigning him to a position that didn't require patient contact, but the plaintiff himself had rejected that. So that turned out not to be an accommodation the court needed to look at. The Stopa case is another case where we have a healthcare provider having a difficult time in the workplace. This was a hospital resident who had impaired vision, and it was that came from a head injury that he incurred during medical school, and that resulted in acquired dyslexia, which slowed down his reading dramatically. And initially, the hospital tried to accommodate him. I guess the general standard was that you needed to be seeing 10 to 15 patients, and spending about 15 minutes with them, and he was only able to see 2 to 3 patients during the day or during this particular period of review, and was spending 40 to 50 minutes per patient because of the slowed down reading and other issues that he had. And unfortunately, his performance continued to deteriorate. The employer documented that. He had issues with memory and decision making, and he also wasn't able to recognize his own limitations. So when they said, you know, I think you're having a difficulty with that, he was a little bit belligerent in the workplace about recognizing the problems that he was having. And so ultimately he was terminated because of the issues involving his cognitive impairments and his slowed down reading. And the court upheld and said that termination was proper and that it was posing a direct threat to patient safety. Not only was he slower, but because of his issues with memory and decision making, he wasn't performing well even at a slower pace. The thing that I think this court also pointed out that's helpful generally in these cases is that most courts have found that employers are not required to change performance standards. So if the performance standard is to see 10 to 15 patients, that's one that most courts are going to uphold. What the reasonable accommodation is not to change the performance standards, but is to help them meet those performance standards through the accommodation, and that was not able to be worked out for him, so the termination was deemed appropriate under the ADA. You might remember, if you joined us for previous webinars, that last year we did a whole webinar on issues of people with disabilities who had drug and alcohol issues, as well as conduct standards, and how that worked out in a variety of settings. And we've seen these alcohol and substance abuse issues arise in the healthcare setting as well. So we wanted to just highlight a few of those. And as you can imagine, most courts have been rather deferential to the healthcare provider regarding healthcare workers who have drug and alcohol issues. But let's just go through a few of those. The first one is the Altman case out of New York, and this was the top dog. The chief of medicine had been visibly drunk while treating a patient, and the hospital board said, you need to get treatment, and we might consider allowing you to return. And he actually did get treatment, got clean, and after 3 months of recovery, tried to return, and the healthcare provider ultimately decided that he could not return. And I think this is a good example of cases where the courts are very deferential to the healthcare setting. There's other cases out there that once a person gets clean and returns, as long as they stay clean, that they're able to return to the workplace. But because of the issues of risk to patient safety that could happen if there was a relapse, the court was deferential to the healthcare provider here and said that they did not have to let him return, even though he was clean and sober for several months. And the Becker case is another case involving a patient who was under the influence. And this was analyzed less on a direct threat and just said that this doctor had violated the conduct standard of not, that you're not allowed to consume alcohol while at work. And generally, courts are going to uphold these conduct standards. The main thing is that employers have to enforce them consistently. So if they don't enforce them consistently, let's say they enforce the conduct standard against the person with disability but not against the person who may be just a casual drinker, then they may not be able to use that conduct standard to terminate people with disabilities. So conduct standards can be effective, but they need to be done consistently. The Nicholson case involved another person who had issues of substance abuse. She was a nurse who had alcoholism, post-traumatic stress disorder, and depression as a result of some being a crime victim. And ultimately, they found that she was a direct threat. She had agreed to sign what's called a last chance agreement that basically said she would never drink again, which was interesting because she ended up drinking again and calling a coworker visibly drunk, and the coworker reported her, but when she was drinking and called the coworker, she was off duty. And she said, you know, I should only be responsible for conduct in the workplace. And the court said, well, you signed this agreement, and this agreement says that you agreed not to drink at all on or off work, and you violated that agreement. So I think this case may have gone a little differently if there wasn't this last chance agreement, because it's pretty unusual for courts to be able to enforce conduct rules for off-duty conduct unless you can show how it would influence their on-duty performance. So that may have been the tipping point in that particular case. And then the Dovermeyer case involved a nurse who was stealing prescription medication, and again, a conduct standard that she violated that was upheld not to have stealing in the workplace or misuse of medication. We did find a case, the Griel case, G-R-I-E-L, where a case involving drug and alcohol, the plaintiff actually won. And this was a nurse who had been terminated previously for diverting narcotics. She was taking narcotics, and she ultimately went through a major addiction recovery program, including one that was just for nurses. But when she returned to work, there were some claims that she was still violating some protocol, and so she was terminated. But what was interesting is that they claimed that she was taking drugs, but they kept testing her over and over, and she always turned up clean. But even though she turned up clean under the drug test, they still terminated her based on some allegations that she had been stealing narcotics. Ultimately, the court found that the termination was pretext because they had experts who testified she did not deviate from the protocol, and that actually the employer just didn't want her back in the workplace, and that they acted discriminatorily. And there was also good evidence that she hadn't done anything to harm any patients under her care. And so in this case, there was no showing of a significant risk of substantial harm, and therefore no direct threat requiring dismissal of the case. Just a couple more cases in which the healthcare worker won their case. The Haas case involved an orthopedic surgeon who had had a hypomanic episode during his first surgery. The employer claimed that during the surgery, the doctor couldn't remember the names of surgical instruments and was unable to perform the surgery without assistance. But the doctor said that wasn't the case. He was just acting a little bit more jovial than usual, and that he was still thinking clearly and knew what he was doing. The opinion didn't indicate what he was doing that was jovial, so he can, I don't know if he was dancing around the operating room or what he was doing, but in any event, there was a dispute on really what happened. He ended up going on leave, and then he returned, and there were opinions that said his condition had now stabilized and he should be reinstated, and the hospital said, we're only going to let you come back if you can actually have a board-certified orthopedic surgeon sit in on every surgery that you do, and he was unable to find somebody who would do that, and so therefore they terminated him as being a direct threat, and the court said that, you know, the termination was improper here because there were issues of fact of whether he did pose any kind of risk to patient safety and whether that accommodation that the employer provided of only returning if you can have a board-certified orthopedic surgeon, if they could have found another way for him to return and monitor his performance other than what they had done, and that they had taken too rigid a view of reasonable accommodation, so therefore the termination was inappropriate. And then the French case is a case involving somebody who actually wasn't a direct healthcare provider. She was an administrative supervisor who had been falling in the workplace because of her muscular dystrophy, and she had been placed on leave. And the court found that her termination was improper because she didn't provide patient care during emergency situations, despite the healthcare providers claimed that she did, and that all she did was document and analyze the process. And so, therefore, this is a good example where they had to do an individualized assessment as to what her actual duties were, and her duties didn't involve direct patient care, and therefore she was not a direct threat. And then just a couple more cases before we close. We've got the EEOC versus Midwest Division RMC case, and this again was somebody who wasn't providing direct care. She was a secretary, but she was in a cardiac unit, and she had issues involving her vision, and she had some patient care duties as far as responding to call lights and inputting patient information, sorting medication, and transporting bodily fluids. But she wasn't doing direct patient contact, and they had cited safety concerns because of her vision issues. And the court found that the employer failed to, that she really wasn't a direct threat because the employer had failed to really analyze what accommodations were available to reduce any kind of threat there might be there. So there might have been adaptive equipment that could have been used, like a 20/20 pen, which in reading this case I learned is an extra bold, thick tip pen that makes it easier for people with low vision to read, and that there were all kinds of different adaptive equipment that could have made her able to do her job if the employer was willing to engage in that interactive process. We also have a couple of other cases involving maybe tangential healthcare workers. One is a firefighter, the McCann case, and this was a firefighter who used a pacemaker, and the employer had sort of a knee-jerk reaction saying that they were concerned that the radio that firefighters and EMTs use would mess up her pacemaker, but I guess the pacemakers have become more sophisticated in recent years, and that was an unjustified view of threat to that person's safety, and so therefore it was inappropriate, the actions that the employer had taken. And then the final case is an interesting case involving a social worker. This is the Rojek case, R-O-J-E-K. And this social worker had been denied an interview for a clinical therapist position for an outpatient mental health agency because she was blind. And the employer said, you know, she can't be a clinical social worker if she's blind, because she won't be able to see. You have to do site visits and home visits, and she wouldn't be able to pick up on visual cues of abuse neglect. And the plaintiff had a lot of evidence of how she was a very effective clinical social worker, and how she had had 26 years of picking up on non-visual cues. And the employer here tried to move for summary judgment, and the court said, no, you have no experience with blind therapists, and you're basing your judgment really on stereotypes and the misperception of the person, not the facts. You failed to do an individualized assessment to learn how she handled these issues previously, and therefore your failure to hire her case can continue since you didn't even interview the applicant to get more information. So that was another case where, when you're talking about direct threat, if the employer fails to do an individualized factual inquiry, they can be found liable under the ADA. So that's the end of the Title I employment cases. We'll look in the chat box and see if there's any questions that people have, and if so, we'll answer those now, and if not, we can move on to the other parts and then answer any questions you have at the end. So if you have any questions, just type it in the chat box, and we'll take a look. Okay, well, I'm not seeing any questions right now, so rather than wait, we'll just go ahead and have Alan start. And if you have questions on the employment, we'll save time at the end for those as well. So I'll turn it over to Alan.
Okay, thanks. Thank you, Barry and Robin. And I also just wanted to mention, before we get to Title III and Title II issues, that our agency has handled a few cases on behalf of nurses with disabilities who sought reasonable accommodations. And even though it seems the courts were a little more willing to accommodate nurses than doctors, we were able to finally settle the cases, but they were both very challenging in terms of all the steps we had to go through in order to resolve them. Both cases ended up in federal court. One was for a nurse with a visual impairment who sought to have some of her duties changed and provided some technology that would make reading charts and equipment easier. And the other nurse had mobility impairments and sought to use a cart and other things to help distribute medication. So these issues are really important, and in the healthcare setting, it's really important for employees, and as we get to patients, it's equally important for patients. So I'm going to be talking about Title III, and we're keying on Title III, but Title II also applies, which Title II is for government entities. Title III is public accommodations. The only real difference in the standards between the two is that Title II entities can provide programmatic access. It doesn't necessarily have to be each and every facility, although we have found no cases that stated that a Title II entity did not have to provide access to the specific facility due to the Title II programmatic access requirement. So I think with few exceptions, the standards are pretty similar. And on slide 36, you can see the different items we'll be covering under Titles II and III, the DOJ regs, legal standing, patients living with HIV, effective communication issues, service animal issues, and then some settlements. And we're referencing another ADA Great Lakes brief on Title III for people who want more information in general, not just the healthcare setting. So I'm sorry, I'm moving too quick. I'm so excited. So anyway, I wanted to mention there's a DOJ and Health and Human Services fact sheet about access to medical care dated July 2010, which just kind of outlines the general ADA requirements under Titles II and III, and that people need to have full and equal access to health care services and facilities, and that these facilities must make reasonable modifications to policies, practices, and procedures. The fact sheet does contain some specific information, and I just included one example here of what an accessible examination room should look like. They also have diagrams, and if you go on the ada.gov website, you can access those diagrams. The diagrams are also alt tags, so they should be compatible with screen reading software But they get into, you know, some specifics, how to do an accessible examination room, accessible equipment, etc. And beyond the DOJ HHS fact sheet, there are also proposed regulations pending from the Department of Justice covering the items we see in slide 39, medical examination treatment tables and chairs, accessible scales, radiological diagnostic equipment, lifts, infusion pumps, rehab equipment, hospital beds, etc. Comments were due about a year ago, but the final regulations, as far as I know, have not been out yet. So moving on to legal standing, and again, this issue was covered in more depth in the webinar and in the brief we did on Title III. Generally, Barry and I try to do a really good job of presenting even-handed information showing both sides of issues. One thing about standing, though, kind of irks me as an advocate in that we see legal standing raised and the person must show a personalized injury in fact. But they also have to show a likelihood of future harm that they intend to return to the facility, and it must be likely rather than speculative. The issue I have is we don't see this legal standing issue raised in other areas of discrimination. For example, in race discrimination, courts don't generally require that an individual show they want to return to the facility that barred them because of their race. However, in the disability setting, we do see this standing issue raised, and for anyone bringing a lawsuit, it is a barrier that has to be overcome. The first case is the McInnes case, which involved a woman with rheumatoid arthritis who uses a wheelchair. She was not pregnant but was planning on having a child and filed suit as the hospital nearest to her did not have any wheelchair accessible rooms in the afterbirth recovery area. And the court held that because she was not pregnant at the time, she did not have legal standing as the case was not ripe. And the court noted that there were many contingencies that might prevent the case from ever becoming ripe. She might not become pregnant, may end up using a different hospital. There might be delivery complications which prevent her from going to the afterbirth recovery room, which is what happened the previous time she gave birth. And then the court also noted that there was no hardship on the plaintiff if she can wait until she's pregnant before bringing a lawsuit. And for those of us familiar with the path that lawsuits take, it might seem a little unlikely that it could get resolved during the course of her pregnancy, but the magistrate judge indicated he felt certain that it could be resolved in that time. The next case is Chambers versus Melmed, which was a woman who was blind and who was denied insemination treatments. And in this case also, the court found that there was no standing because the plaintiff had moved prior to filing suit, and the doctor had stopped offering artificial insemination services, so therefore the likelihood of future harm was not existent. And then we have a query for a little vote. In the earlier case, the McInnes case, do you agree that it was not a hardship on Ms. McInnes Meisner to require that she file suit only after becoming pregnant? If you agree with the court that it was not a hardship to wait until she was pregnant to file, please hit the check or control 1 for yes or the X or control 2 for no. And I'll publish those results in a second or two. Some people are changing their mind. I see votes changing. And all right, time she up. So it looks like 28% of the people said no, they do not agree with the court. 23% said yes, they do agree with the court, and 48% did not vote. You know, the one issue that I guess I had with that is that you almost have to run when you find out you're pregnant and you're probably 2 to 3 months along, you almost have to run to court to get the case started in order to get the injunctive relief the magistrate judge thought would be forthcoming. The next case is Rose versus Cahey, which involved a prisoner who was denied gallbladder surgery because she was living with HIV. She was released from prison after filing her lawsuit and now lived 80 miles away from the clinic that refused to treat her. Unlike the prior case where the court said there was no standing because the person was no longer close to the facility, in this case the court held there was standing because they looked at standing at the time she filed suit. And at the time she filed suit, she was still a prisoner, and still it was likely that she may return to that clinic. And it's, I did also wanted to point out that, to note that it was a religious organization that owned the clinic, and the religious organization was dismissed from the lawsuit due to the ADA's religious exemption under Title III. However, the clinic itself, which had a secular board, that lawsuit against the clinic was allowed to go forward. And the big difference between the Chambers case we saw earlier and this case is that Rose moved after filing suit, whereas in Chambers the plaintiff moved before she filed suit. The next case, Benavides versus Laredo Medical Center, was a man with a heart condition who is deaf, who had severe coughing and a fluttering heart. And he actually had two medical conditions. He had diabetes as well as his heart condition and had a pacemaker. Upon his arrival, he requested a sign language interpreter, but this was not provided. Instead, two nurses attempted to give him written notes, one nurse in English and one in Spanish, which was a little ironic as Mr. Benavides did not speak Spanish. And therefore, he claimed that due to the complexity of the information and the fact that he did not understand Spanish, the notes were ineffective. It's also be pointed out that this hospital was the closest to his residence. He had used the hospital many times for his medical conditions. In fact, in a span of 4 months, he had to use the hospital 3 times. And in each of those 3 visits, he requested an interpreter, and that request was denied. The plaintiff complained that decisions about his condition and treatment were made while he was, quote, completely unaware of what was happening to him, end quote. And the court looked at the following factors: his proximity to the hospital, the number of prior visits, whether his medical conditions will require attention in the future, and whether the hospital has changed its policies. And after examining those factors, the court held the plaintiff had standing to bring suit. The hospital said that it would provide accommodations in the future, but there was really no policy in place. They had no evidence that staff had been trained on the policy. So the court viewed that as nothing more than a bare statement. And it also held that plaintiff's claim for monetary damages could proceed. And the court said for damages, you don't need to show what they call discriminatory animus, meaning purpose or intent, to show intentional discrimination. A failure to comply with the law and deliberate indifference was all the plaintiff had to show. And in this case, there was evidence that the hospital may have acted with deliberate indifference. The next case is a very famous one, the first ADA case to get to the U.S. Supreme Court, Bragdon versus Abbott, which involved a dentist's refusal to treat a patient due to her positive HIV status. And the Supreme Court held that the dentist's conduct violated the ADA. They used a direct threat analysis and found that the dentist's decision was not objectively reasonable. The dentist claimed to be an expert acting on good faith, a good faith belief of significant risk of harm. However, the dentist offered no outside evidence to support his assertion, and the court ruled against the dentist and in favor of the patient. In the next case we have here, Doe versus Division of Youth and Family Services, involved a plaintiff living with HIV who gave birth at Capital Health System. The hospital was concerned about the plaintiff having HIV and the possibility that her child might have HIV, and took some extreme steps. The hospital set up an emergency guardianship over the newly born child and contacted the police to prevent the mother from leaving the hospital with her child. It sounds like they actually stopped her as she was wheeling out with her child in her arms. And the hospital also disclosed her HIV status to family members and the police, refused to give the mother any oral medication, and also administered AZT to the child without the mother's permission, and it was later discovered that the baby was not HIV positive. In this case, the court held that the actions may violate the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act, although the court did hold that the individual medical staff had no individual liability, it would just be liability on behalf of the facility. And now we're going to look at cases involving effective communication. We have a few of those. In the Constance case, the hospital tried to secure an American Sign Language ASL interpreter for an emergency room patient and her husband, who were both deaf. and the court held that the hospital was not liable when it could not secure an interpreter, as it made a good faith attempt to obtain the interpreter. And the plaintiff did not show concrete plans or a possibility of returning to the hospital, so did not have standing to get injunctive relief. And we want to point out that today, with advances in technology like remote interpreters, video relay, it might be much easier for hospitals to provide interpreter services. You might not necessarily have to have a live person there if you can utilize one of the computer video relay services for remote interpreters. So technology is really making it easier for people with many different types of disabilities to gain access, as long as the healthcare provider is up on the latest technology. The next case is Myoka versus Turner. And this involved an individual who is deaf who wanted an interpreter when speaking with an ear, nose, and throat specialist about that individual's infant son. The doctor's office wanted to write notes instead of hiring an interpreter. And when the father said, no, that won't be effective for me, the doctor sent a letter saying the appointment was canceled, as we cannot meet your needs in caring for your child. The doctor pointed to the fact that note-taking is listed as an example of an acceptable auxiliary aid. But the court says, well, it goes farther than that. It's listed as an acceptable auxiliary aid, but it was raised in the context in some DOJ guidance in terms of, for example, at a bookstore might be able to use notes. However, there was language from the U.S. Attorney General that a lot of areas, including health, legal matters, and finances, may almost always require an interpreter for effective communication. And the court looked at this and said in this case that it was not clear that the notes would be more effective than an interpreter, and therefore summary judgment was denied to the medical provider, as a genuine issue of fact existed whether note-taking can be considered an effective form of communication in the healthcare setting. And this case is different than the prior case, than the Constance case, where the hospital had a written policy on interpreters and made good faith attempts. Here, the doctor, of course, has said, no, we'll just pass notes, that's fine. And even though it was the parent who was deaf and not the patient, the court still ruled for the plaintiff and that the healthcare provider had to provide an interpreter. And in fact, in the healthcare setting, I don't think we discovered any cases where a court ruled that passing notes was sufficient when an individual requested an interpreter. Invariably, the courts have found that an interpreter is required for effective communication if that's what the plaintiff desires. The next case, Loeffler, had facts that I found somewhat amazing. Each one seemed to be even more amazing than the one before. In this case, the hospital refused to provide an interpreter to a heart surgery patient and his wife, both of whom were deaf. They began requesting interpreters 2 to 3 weeks before they were admitted, but the hospital made really no attempts to find interpreters and used the plaintiff's minor children, age 13 and 17, to interpret. For example, after the surgery, and there's more detailed listing of the facts in the brief, which you'll receive after the webinar, in the recovery room, they used the 13-year-old to interpret, even though he told the doctor he didn't feel comfortable, I don't understand some of the terms, and said that the doctor laughed it off, as he always did, patted him on the back, and told him he was doing fine. And the surgery that the patient went in for was heart surgery designed to prevent a stroke. Nevertheless, within a day of the surgery, the patient suffered a stroke, grabbing his ankle and writhing in pain. Bobby, the 13-year-old, alerted a nearby nurse who responded with indifference and said, well, that's how deaf people communicate. What do you know? You're a kid. Bobby, to his credit, continued to raise his disturbance. He knew, I think, a lot about how his dad was trying to communicate, and finally got the doctor to return, who then wanted Bobby to interpret to his mom that Bobby's dad had a stroke and needed more surgery. Bobby said that interpreting was amazingly overwhelming for him. He did not even know what a stroke was. And over the next 2 weeks, as the father recovered from his stroke in the hospital, and it was intensive care for a good portion of that time, the children served as interpreters and ended up missing school so they'd be available whenever they were needed. They filed suit, and both children claimed to have suffered depression as a result of the father's stroke and the role they performed in relaying medical information. And Bobby said, I felt like my dad needed me to help him, and I couldn't help him. And at that point, while the father was still in the hospital, the family filed a lawsuit, and then the hospital started providing an interpreter. What I found surprising on top of the facts is the district court granted summary judgment to the hospital, saying that they did not see any, while the hospital did not provide an interpreter, they did not think it amounted to the deliberate indifference necessary to show discrimination under the ADA. Fortunately for the family, the appellate court disagreed with the district court and said that a hospital may have acted with deliberate indifference in denying the request for an interpreter and TTY. The hospital policy required an interpreter in this situation. In fact, a patient rep on staff of the hospital told the nurses, gave her two phone numbers, and told the nurses to hire one of those interpreters. The nurse never even called, and then later told the hospital patient rep, oh yeah, we have interpreters, apparently referring to the two children. The appellate court held that the family's claim for money damages under the Rehabilitation Act could proceed, that the children's claim under the Rehabilitation Act, in addition to the mother and father, could proceed, as well as a negligent claim against the doctor was also able to proceed. And we have a sad note that Mr. Loeffler died soon after filing his federal lawsuit. And then we have a query. I may have jumped the gun and partially answered that, but our query is, can passing notes ever be effective communication for a patient who is deaf? So please vote a check mark for yes, the X for no, control 1 for yes, control 2 for no. So if everyone could vote, that would be great. All right, and I will publish the results, 3-2-1. So it looks like 23% think passing notes wrote no, passing notes can never be effective for a patient who is deaf. 18% think passing notes might be effective in some situations for a patient who is deaf. And 58% did not respond. I feel like we're seeing the same hands, so let's try to get everyone in on the voting next time. And then there are some DOJ, Department of Justice, settlements, and we have a link there to the ADA.gov website that has some of these. And there are many cases regarding interpreters, and the relief is similar in all of these, requiring that the healthcare provider provide auxiliary aids, including interpreters, free of charge. They respond within a time frame, usually 48 hours, requiring staff training on policies and auxiliary aids, how to use video remote interpreting services, giving notice to the community and hospital's personnel. And this is so important. Once a hospital adopts a policy, the next important step is making sure that staff is trained. Policies also must prohibit the use of family members or other unqualified people to interpret, develop complaint resolution mechanisms, up-to-date lists of interpreters, also provide captioned television and videos. In some cases, a medical provider might show you a video kind of explaining some background on a general medical condition, but often those are not captioned. And DOJ also required monetary damages and fines. There's some DOJ commentary from the recent regulations that were passed on service animals following the guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, generally that access should be allowed for service animals in all areas with the possible exceptions of operating rooms and burn units. And we have links there to the DOJ commentary as well as the Center for Disease Control guidance. And then looking at service animals in the healthcare context, we have a list here of some tasks that service animals may be required to perform. And again, there's an ADA Great Lakes brief on service animals in general, and we urge people to look at those too if you have some more service animal questions. But some tasks that service animals may perform are pulling a wheelchair, assisting an individual during a seizure, alerting individuals to the presence of allergens, retrieving items such as medicine or telephone, providing support and assistance with balance and stability, and helping people with psychiatric and neurological disabilities by preventing or interrupting impulsive or destructive behaviors. And those are just some examples of tasks. So we have a service animal case here, Roe versus Providence Health Systems. In this case, the patient has a service dog with what the court described as a putrid odor, which ended up resulting in patient transfers due to the odor. They were having breathing difficulty. Nurses had developed some allergic reactions as well and had to be assigned to alternative duties. The dog was fairly large. It was a Saint Bernard. And it may have had an infection as well. The hospital offered a compromise by requesting the patient close her door when the dog was present and offered to provide a HEPA, if I'm pronouncing that right, air filter. However, the plaintiff said due to her claustrophobia and the noise from the filter, she did not like those proposed solutions. And the court found in favor of the healthcare provider, saying it was a direct threat to allow access for the service animal due to the putrid odor and the infection, and dismissed plaintiff's case and enjoined her from bringing any service animal to the hospital if she returned. And the court noted the hospital's history of accommodating service animals. And in this case, I believe the hospital even offered to have the animal put in a kennel, but plaintiff refused that offer as well. In the Smith versus Mormon case on slide 57, a VA medical center did not, the court found a one-page, very brief decision. The court found the VA did not discriminate by refusing the veteran's request to keep his dog with him during hospitalization. The court found that Mr. Smith was not denied treatment. He received full treatment, and that his disability played no role in the decision to prohibit the dog from staying. And so Mr. Smith lost that case. And then we have the Shuley case, which involved an individual with blindness who was bringing her son to an MRI facility, and she also brought her service animal as well. And she was prohibited from entering the MRI space with her service animal, with the facility citing space and safety concerns, the need to keep out metal objects. The mother, Ms. Shealy, filed suit, and 9 months after the suit was filed, the hospital modified its no animal policy, allowing access with a few specific exemptions. But the court held the fact that the MRI facility modified its no animal policy did not make the plaintiff's case moot, and her ADA claim was allowed to proceed. The court said the plaintiff or the defendant has a high burden to establish the challenged conduct cannot reasonably be expected to start up again, and it's not enough to simply say, we're not going to do that again. And the court stated that our binding precedent says that, quote, voluntary cessation of offensive conduct will only moot litigation if it is clear that the defendant has not changed course, simply to deprive the court of jurisdiction. So I think the court was kind of thinking, well, yeah, you changed your policy after the suit was filed just to kind of show the court, see, we changed it, now throw out the lawsuit. And the court just said that wasn't enough. And the court felt it could not say with any degree of confidence, let alone with absolute clarity, that defendant would not engage in the same conduct in the future. We also want to point out this case demonstrates the association provision of the ADA, because the case was not brought by the patient, but by the patient's mother who used a service animal. And then a very recent settlement from 2012, earlier this month, from HHS, settled a service animal case on behalf of an individual with a spinal disability who used a service animal and was denied admission to St. Edward Mercy Medical Center. They told him that his animal was not a service animal because it was not a seeing eye dog, and of course, especially under the new DOJ regulations, service animals can provide a lot of tasks in addition to helping someone who's blind have assistance with navigation. The facility also sought to have vaccination tags or records verifying the health of the animal, and the person cannot supply these, but under the law, of course, these cannot be required by facilities. And we have there a link to the press release of the HHS settlement. There's some other settlements with DOJ. We picked out one that seemed kind of exemplary, the U.S. versus ASHFAC, which was a woman in a wheelchair who had trouble accessing an examination table and requested the doctor purchase a lift or an adjustable table. The doctor said, my budget doesn't allow it, and I'm not going to treat you anymore. And then Department of Justice got involved, and the case was settled with the doctor agreeing to purchase an adjustable exam table, adopt a non-discrimination policy, train her staff so that when a patient calls up, the staff will ask if she needs any, if the patient needs any special assistance or auxiliary aids due to disability. The staff and doctor are required to undergo ADA training, pay some damages, and report compliance to DOJ. And there's a link to the settlement on slide 61. Sorry about that. I'm jumping around a bit. Here's the other case. Sorry, there's another DOJ settlement, which was a little different, which involved biomedics, which involved people who wanted to donate plasma. And it involved access for potential plasma donors with sensory impairments. And as a result of this case, Department of Justice entered into a wide-ranging agreement with biomedics, providing that biomedics adopt, post, and train staff regarding policies that require having staff work one-on-one with individuals to make sure they're acclimated to and comfortable in the facility. And if you look at the settlement, it's very detailed, both for people who are blind and on behalf of patients who are deaf, with requiring staff to take them around the facility to explain things, provide an interpreter if required, and deferring, requiring that the staff defer to donor preferences for reasonable accommodations, detailed visual descriptions, and utilizing sign language interpreters or other auxiliary aids. And again, a very detailed settlement. And this is not people who are seeking treatment, but people who are seeking to donate plasma. But as this case shows, or the settlement shows, these people are protected by the ADA as well. There's a way of resolving cases without filing a lawsuit called structured negotiations, which has been highly successful. It's, as we describe here, a collaborative and solution-driven advocacy and dispute resolution method conducted without litigation. A private attorney in California, Lainey Feingold, who Equip for Equality has worked with on occasion, has used structured negotiations to increase accessibility, including access to technology and information beyond the healthcare setting. Healthcare setting. They've been used, for example, with ATM machines. They've been reached agreements through structured negotiations in the healthcare setting with the University of California San Francisco Medical Center, Massachusetts General Hospital, and Brigham Young and Women's Hospital in Boston, or maybe Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. And they've also been used in terms of accessible healthcare information and website access and alternative formats and things like that. And for example, the American Cancer Society has agreed to design and modify its website in accordance with website accessibility standards, as well as undertaking a pilot program to make its printed material available in alternative formats, including Braille, large print, audio, and electronic formats. So we have some more information, a link at the bottom of this slide to accessible healthcare information. And then we also wanted to mention an initiative called the Barrier-Free Healthcare Initiative, which is a group of disability rights lawyers and advocates. And their efforts to support legal and policy initiatives aimed at eliminating physical and programmatic barriers that people with disabilities face in obtaining health care. And we have a link there for more information on this organization. And then there's also Disability Rights Advocates, a nonprofit organization that's entered into several settlements with healthcare providers, and that we have a link to those settlements. And we point out one case there which involved access to mammogram machines for women with disabilities. And the press release points out just how the statistics and studies show how people with disabilities have far less access to healthcare than people without disabilities. And their press release notes that studies have shown that women with severe disabilities get half as many mammograms and pap smears as women without disabilities. And although accessible mammography equipment exists, very few providers use them. And it's hopeful that the new DOJ regulations on accessible medical equipment will help remedy some of these problems. And we have some practical tips for people. First, we kind of combine titles 1 and 3 together. So first, for employers and healthcare providers, 1, periodic AD training, including new hires. We think that's so key, especially in the employment setting. So often it seems that ADA cases arise because a new supervisor comes in who wasn't trained on the ADA and terminates accommodations that were in place. And we feel that training new hires and periodically training all staff would help prevent employers and healthcare providers from a lot of legal headaches and issues later, and they can more fully comply with the ADA and avoid problems in federal lawsuits just through staff training. And as the case is pointed out, an individualized inquiry is required every time. And it must use the best available objective medical and scientific evidence when supporting direct threat defenses. Facilities should not, and employers should not, rely on stereotypes, but instead do that individualized factual inquiry. And both employers and employees need to fully engage in the interactive process. Employers are allowed to request limited additional medical information if the disability or need for the accommodation is not known or apparent, and these should be requested using appropriate medical releases. We think it's very important for employers and healthcare providers to have appropriate policies on reasonable accommodations, reasonable modifications to, for example, a no animal policy, as well as policies for direct threat, public access, and other related issues. It's very important for employers and healthcare providers to document, 1, any reasonable accommodation efforts they make. If an accommodation is proposed and turned down by a patient or an employee, it's very helpful for employers and healthcare providers to document those, as well as relevant facts, jobs, duties, performance issues, and undue hardship or undue burden, undue hardship Title 1, undue burden Title 3, if that's relevant to the situation. And now some practical tips for employees and patients. Request for reasonable accommodations to identify the impairment, limitations, and accommodation preference if known. And employees also should document everything, reasonable accommodation requests, any offers, relevant discussions. If an employee or patient feels they're being harassed or retaliated against or treated differently due to requesting an accommodation or due to their disability, those should be documented as well. But employees and patients have to follow appropriate policies and procedures and workplace conduct rules. And if a medical provider, if an employer asks for medical information, they're entitled to it. It's incumbent upon the employee to provide that, or the employee may be deemed responsible for any breakdowns in the interactive process. Employees are allowed in most states to obtain personnel files. And again, while facilities cannot require service animal identification, many disability groups encourage people to carry some information, or at least a card telling providers that they cannot request vaccination information, that this is a service animal, etc. And that can help alleviate problems. Even if it's not required, I think it is a good idea for patients and people who use service animals to carry some of that information just in case. And if an employee or a patient can provide detailed information on an auxiliary they need, that's always helpful as well. We have here some general ADA resources, the National Network of ADA Centers. The Equal Opportunity Commission has a lot of great guidance on these issues. Equip for Equality, our organization, the Illinois Protection and Advocacy Agency, and every state and U.S. territory has its own protection and advocacy agency. the Job Accommodation Network can be also very helpful in these situations, and there's also a lot of guidance and settlement information from Department of Justice, and some as well from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And as Barry mentioned in the beginning, Illinois attorneys are eligible for 1.5 hours of continuing legal education credit, CLE credit. And if you desire this, you need to send an email to barryt@equipforequality.org. And we have some time, about 9 minutes, I think, for questions at the end. I just want to let everyone know that our next session is March 21st, 2012, or the next session through the ADA National Network on Olmstead Planning, Litigation, Collaboration, and the All-Important Financial Calculation. The speaker will be Tally Wells, Attorney and Director of the Mental Health and Disability Rights Project for the Atlanta Legal Aid Society. There's also going to be a session evaluation email to participants, and with that, I'm going to throw the mic open to Robin and Barry, and I think we can take questions. I think I saw a few coming in the chat area.
Hi, this is Barry. I did see a question that was raised regarding at-will employment from Dana, and basically the question was, how does the ADA interact if you are in an at-will employment state? And for those of you who aren't familiar with that terminology, at-will means that basically people can be terminated for any reason whatsoever. So these are people who do not have an employment contract. However, the major big exception to at-will employment is that you cannot do so if it would be a violation of public policy, and courts have interpreted that violation of public policy to include anti-discrimination laws. So if you're violating an anti-discrimination law in an at-will employment state, the ADA or the relevant anti-discrimination law would trump. And there was an addendum to Dana's question where she said that, you know, if the action that was done was not intentional or overt discrimination intended. As we've talked about in previous sessions, you can have violations of the ADA even if it's not intentional discriminatory conduct. So, for instance, if you have a policy that would somehow have a discriminatory impact on people with disabilities, then that can be discrimination even if it wasn't necessarily intended by the employer. Now, the fact that something is not intentional or there is no discriminatory animus, as Alan talked about, can affect issues regarding punitive damages, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you would not be deemed liable under the ADA. So at-will employment states still have to comply with the ADA. And I think that's the only question I've seen so far. Alan's also saying even an at-will employer cannot terminate or discriminate against someone based on protected class. So supporting, I think, what I just said. Looks like we have another question. It said, would student interns or volunteers in healthcare settings be covered by ADA protections? Alan, I recall that there was some guidance out there on volunteers. Do you remember that off the top of your head?
There's some guidance on temporary workers and some EEOC guidance on volunteers, which they may have recalled, because I know we had trouble locating it recently. Volunteers, one issue with volunteers, it might be a Title III issue rather than a Title I issue, unless the volunteer can show that they get some type of benefit, either protected by workers' comp insurance, or if they get a stipend, or something like that. But I think generally the issue would come down to whether it's Title I or Title III, but I think generally it's safe to say that interns and volunteers would be covered by one of the two titles. The one big exception comes when it's a volunteer at a religious organization, because then, because they're a volunteer and not an employee, you have to look at Title III, but Title III has an exemption for a religious organization. So volunteers for religious organizations might not be covered unless they can show that they get some type of benefit to bring them under the Title I protections. So I hope I explained that okay.
Great. Yeah, that makes sense. Any other questions that people have? Now's the time to type it into your chat box.
I wanted to point out that it was interesting that we had a couple cases that Barry talked about, which were an employment setting case, but it was done under Title III of the ADA, which in those cases offered protection to people, to independent contractors. That law is really not fully developed. It's funny because most of the Title III independent contractor cases that we find overall include doctors. And I'm not sure if that's because it's doctors are the main ones who can afford an attorney to bring a Title III case because there's no damages, so a lot of attorneys might not provide representation. But the Title III issue is very interesting, as doctors may be covered as independent contractors, although the law on that is not fully developed, and there are cases going both ways.
I guess the only other thing I just wanted people to hopefully get out of this session is that we talked about the specific context of the healthcare industry, and I think we said it a couple times, but especially with respect to employment, courts have been more narrow in its view of ADA protections for healthcare workers. So if you see a healthcare worker case involving reasonable accommodation and or direct threat, and states took a more narrow view than you think they should, we just think it's important that people don't necessarily think that the same analysis would apply to all employment settings, because, again, courts are just being more deferential because of the issues of potential implications of patient safety and care in the healthcare setting that just doesn't arise in the same context in other settings. So, for instance, the situation of having a doctor who might be drunk at work versus a word processor who's drunk at work. You know, obviously, being drunk at work is a serious thing, but the implications of a surgeon being drunk versus somebody who is doing some administrative tasks might be analyzed differently, and what accommodations you have to do or what whether it rises to a direct threat, again, would be different in the different context. So that needs to be kept in mind, and for people to not necessarily overgeneralize some of these more narrow views of the courts.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Barry. And I want to point out, Robin pasted some info from the EEOC guidance on volunteers, talking about how if the benefits constitute significant remuneration, then the volunteer may be viewed as an employee. And remember, that's EEOC guidance. So if the volunteer is not an employee, then you have to look, shift your look to Title III.
Any other final questions?
Okay, hearing none, I guess we will go ahead and conclude this session. And again, thank you everyone for joining us today and participating in this session. As was indicated, you will be receiving an email that will be a link to the evaluation. We do value your feedback and really do encourage you to respond to us. That email also included an attachment, which will be the legal brief that has been referenced by Barry and Alan during the session. We also would refer you to our other legal briefs that have been created over the past several years on a variety of different ADA-related issues, which can be accessed on our website at www.adagreatlakes.org. So again, thank you, Barry. Thank you, Alan, for once again sharing your expertise in this particular area and a wealth of information. You may disconnect from the session by closing your browser, and or in the lower left-hand corner of your screen, you'll see a little icon that looks like two electric cords going together with a slit in the middle. If you just click on that, that will also disconnect you. Again, thank you, everybody, and we hope to see you at our next session in March. Thank you.